Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are document 040515, Stephen F. Austin State University versus Diane Flynn from Nacogdoches County and the 12th Court of Appeals District. 050311, In Re Auto Nation, Inc. and Auto Imports North Limited, DBA Mercedes-Benz of Houston North, original proceeding. And 060322, Owens & Minor, Inc., Owens & Minor Medical, Inc. versus Ansel Healthcare Products, Inc., Beckton Dickinson Company, which is here on a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the 5th District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we expect to complete all arguments before noon. We will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 040515, Stephen F. Austin State University versus Diane Flynn.
May it please the court, Mr. Kraft will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the court. The court should reverse the Court of Appeals and render judgment for the university for two independent reasons. First, because the university dedicated a public easement so that people like the Flynns could cycle across its campus for recreation, it is entitled to the protections of the recreational use statute. And Flynn cannot invoke the gross negligence exception to that statute because the evidence attached to the university's plea establishes that the university was not grossly negligent.
How is this different from the Ricky Shoemake case?
This is different from the Shoemake case with respect to whether the university can establish gross negligence. In Shoemake, the court held that based on the allegations and the evidence that there was a fact question as to gross negligence, and it had to be remanded for that reason because the culvert at issue in that case was a hidden peril. In contrast, in this case, we are dealing with a sprinkler that is open, that is in the middle of a field, that is spraying water 15 to 20 feet in the air. And it is an obvious condition, and as the court described in Shoemake, that is a circumstance under which the defendant cannot be grossly negligent. That is the distinction.
If it were a hidden condition, would she make a fine?
If it were a hidden condition, then it would be closer to Shoemake.
Do we have in the record what type of sprinkler system this is? In other words, did it pop up on a timer? Open and obvious would sort of presume that it was operating at the time she came through. And my understanding is the allegation it sort of shot up and activated unexpectedly.
This is what the evidence shows, and I want to go through this in detail with the court so that you'll understand how this happened. And I'll start with Mr. Flynn's deposition because he went through the shot put field first. Mr. Flynn rode through the shot put field where the sprinkler was located first. And his narrative is located at pages 63 through 69 of the record. He's riding in front. As soon as he reached the southern boundary of the shot put field, he saw the sprinkler all the way on the other side of the field operating in the northeastern corner, according to his testimony. What he saw was the water shooting all the way across the field in an arc that he described as being 15 to 20 feet high. As he continued to ride toward it, he saw that it was oscillating. And as he got to the sprinkler, he ducked under the arc and continued riding. He has passed out of view by the time Mrs. Flynn arrives at the shot put field, and her narrative is located at pages 50 through 55 of the record. Like her husband, she saw the sprinkler as soon as she reached the southern boundary of the shot put field. When she got there, she saw it operating in the northeastern corner, and she says it was shooting a big stream of water all the way across the creek to the other side. After that, she put her head down, and she was looking down at the ground as she was riding. And she testified that the next time she became aware of the sprinkler, she was 4 to 6 feet away from it, and that's when it oscillated and hit her. So this is a condition that they observed as soon as they got to the open area where the sprinkler was located.
What if they didn't? And if they didn't observe it, does it matter? Whereas in Shoemake, you had an underground culvert that couldn't be seen by anybody. You had rushing water, and you had a reporting of some near drownings.
It matters because their testimony is the evidence of whether this is open and obvious. And I want to be clear.
What if there's a different fact pattern where someone is riding, sprinkler comes up, boom, and for whatever reason, this gets them off balance, they fall down and break their neck?
If it had popped up out of nowhere, then that would be perhaps a different case.
But well, does that mean that the state or the university system has to go now and remove all of the sprinkler systems that are throughout these campuses?
No, it doesn't. I mean, in this case, the sprinkler attachment is above ground, and they saw it as they approached.
Well, what if they didn't? What if it's below ground, they ride by there, comes up, get knocked off the bike, you break your neck?
Then I think that's a hidden condition, and we're getting into closer to Shoemake, where that could be evidence.
So under Shoemake, the first person you squirt can't sue, but everybody after that can. That's what Shoemake seems to say.
Well,
one person complains of drowning, that's tough, but everybody after that can sue.
Well, I think even in Shoemake, it depends on whether the condition was hidden or obvious at the time even the first person arrived. I want to be clear, we're not relying on the Flynn's testimony to establish their subjective state of mind as to what they knew or didn't know. But their testimony is evidence of what the conditions were in the field at that time, and that does go to whether it is objectively an obvious condition. So that at least under Shoemake, the university is not grossly negligent under those circumstances. And in Shoemake, the court relied on a case from the Utah Supreme Court, Golding versus Ashley Central Irrigation Company. And the quote that the court used from Golding is this: if a landowner has knowledge of an uncommon hidden peril or danger on the land that is not inherent in the use to which the land is put, and that would not be reasonably discovered or avoided by a trespasser, the landowner's failure to warn or guard against such a danger could amount to willful wanton or gross negligence. If you apply that standard to this case, it's very different. The sprinkler was not hidden. They saw it when they entered the field. It's shooting 15 to 20 feet in the air. The sprinkler was inherent in the use of this property. This was a university shot put field. It's a maintained athletic field. It has to be watered. In fact, Mrs. Flynn testified that she had seen sprinklers on other university athletic fields during her bike rides, and that's on
I can appreciate the facts in the case here. I'm concerned with having, if this is a hidden defect, and then requiring the state systems or any public system to go out and have to now put up signs warning bicyclists or pedestrians that here there's a sprinkler system here, if it comes up, you know, don't be surprised, or having them have to modify them at a great expense. If you have a different fact situation and a different type of sprinkler situation.
Well, again, I think it would depend on the facts of those cases, whether the sprinkler actually poses a danger, whether it is concealed. Those are all things that go to this gross negligence exception to the recreational use statute. I would also add that the recreational use statute has been amended since this case was decided. And now, at least as to government entities, their protection under the statute is governed by subsection F, and it is no longer modified by subsection D, which is the grossly negligent exception that the court relied on in Shoemake. Now it just says a governmental unit doesn't owe any greater duty than it does to a trespasser. So if it's a premises defect, there's not going to be a duty to warn or guard against conditions on the property.
What was the second point on your introductory statement going to be?
The second point had to do with Section 101.056. And what the Flynns are challenging are the university's decisions about the design of its sprinkler system and the most effective way to maintain its athletic fields, and those are discretionary acts which the university maintains under Section 101.056. But I want to go back to this question of the application of the statute in the first instance. The Court of Appeals ignored black-letter law when it said that the existence of this easement meant that the university was not an owner of the property where Mrs. Flynn was injured. As this court said in Marcus Cable Associates versus Crone, an easement is a non-possessory interest that authorizes the use of the property for particular purposes, but it doesn't convey the property itself.
Let me make sure I understand the facts. Flynn was riding her bike on Stephen F. Austin's campus. The sprinkler was on an easement, which she pled was owned by the city, correct?
Allegation is that she was cycling on an easement owned by the city but dedicated to public use by the university. The sprinkler was on the shot put field in an area that was not within the easement. That's the allegation. But notwithstanding the existence of the easement, because it's simply a non-possessory interest, the university still owns that property where the trail is located. And that brings it within the plain language of the recreational use statute. Is the university...
I want to be sure of a couple of things. I understand your argument that there can't be both a premises and a negligent activity claim arising out of the same circumstances. But here it seems like the circumstances are a little different because you have, on the one hand, an argument that the way the system is set up is a premises defect because it allows this kind of thing to happen, but the operation of it might be a negligent activity. Why aren't there, just slicing it pretty finely, but why aren't there two causes of action?
There are not two causes of action because although she has pled two causes of action, they are predicated on the same facts. And what she has said is that there was past conduct by university employees in setting up the sprinkler and turning it on, and that once the Flynns entered the shot put field, the operating sprinkler was part of the conditions that they encountered, and there was no contemporaneous conduct by any university employee while that's going on.
And you think if there were a negligent activity claim, it would not be covered by the recreational use statute?
Well, it would. You'd still have the gross negligence exception. And in that sense, the issue of whether this is a negligent activity or a premises defect has kind of dropped out of the case after Shoemake, because it was determinative before, because our position was that the recreational use statute completely closed the immunity waiver for premises defects. But now, after Shoemake, the court has said that's not correct, that whether it's a negligent activity or a premises defect, someone can still evade the restrictions of the statute by showing either past gross negligence in the case of a premises defect or contemporaneous gross negligence in the case of a negligent activity claim. So either way, you've got to show gross negligence. So that distinction really doesn't matter to the case so much after Shoemake. And now what is determinative, once we decide that the recreational use statute applies, is whether there has been gross negligence.
And regardless of that, if it's discretionary, that's another independent ground for your prevailing.
That is an independent ground. If the court did not agree that this evidence established that the university was not grossly negligent, then it would then have to turn to the 101.056 issue.
Can you speak to the distinction between a discretionary act and implementation of it? I mean, it depends on how broad we approach the question. To some extent, everything is policy-based, how things are, where the sprinkler is placed, et cetera. But you can conceive of a situation where the implementation of that policy decision might create liability? What if the, you know, the stream is so forceful that it, you know, it's completely unreasonable, will knock people off, and that and the force is caused by a negligent implementation of that policy?
That, I mean, that could be if it was an implementation, but in this case, and what the court has done with 101 and 056 is it has started by looking at what the allegations are attacking and going through those to establish whether it falls within 101, 056. And the forcefulness of the sprinkler is a design decision. And while we may not think of design decisions as being the formulation of policy, the court has said in numerous cases that engineering design decisions are discretionary acts within 101, 056. So I think that's a category that's been established. And when you're talking about where are we going to place this sprinkler in relation to the shot put field and how much water is it going to spray out, which will determine how much of the shot put field is covered, I mean, that's a design type decision that's just inherent in the sprinkler. The other things she challenges are whether to post warning signs, and that the court has also held to be a discretionary act in State versus Miguel. There's no legal requirement to post a warning, so it necessarily is a discretionary act.
If the decision was discretionary, then it looks to me as if the state is entitled to rendition. Your view of it?
If it's discretionary, then it's entitled to rendition.
If it's just covered by the recreational use statute, would it need to be remanded for further opportunity for the plaintiff to plead gross negligence?
It would not. She has pled gross negligence, but our position is that the evidence attached to our plea, because it establishes that this is an open and obvious condition, means that there cannot be gross negligence. And there's not going to be any better evidence of what the conditions were when the Flynns entered the shop put field. We're not relying on something we pulled out of the file. This is their testimony.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Allen, present argument.
May it please the court. Ladies and gentlemen, it is our position that this case is not a case in which this court should overturn the opinion or the decision of the Court of Appeals. In fact, that the Court of Appeals' decision was right on. Was correct. And we start with the issue of whether or not the recreational use statute applies to this case at all. And there's been a lot of discussion about the significance of whether it's an easement, whether it's not an easement, where the condition was actually geographically located versus where the injury occurred. And the reason this is significant is because when you look at the recreational use statute, it has been written to combine with traditional premises liability law. It discusses the status of the individual who is on the premises, and it says that they are relegated, that they owe no greater duty to that individual than that of a trespasser. Traditional premises liability law does not even apply in this case. The reason is, unlike the easements that are traditionally granted or that are granted to individuals for access to a place, this involved an easement in which a geographical location, an area of land set aside with parameters, with widths, was actually transferred over to the city of Nacogdoches. It wasn't transferred over to the public, as opposing counsel stated. It was transferred over to the city, and the city dedicated it for public use.
How would you transfer it to the public? But for transferring it to the city, I mean.
Well, there have been other situations where you could simply dedicate it to public use. You wouldn't have to transfer it to a governmental entity to open it up for public use.
But the purpose was clearly to open it up for public use.
I agree. But the distinction is that when they transferred it to the city, they no longer had any control whatsoever over that piece of land upon which that trail was located.
They still owned it.
It is, but the distinction is that in the other cases from the other jurisdictions cited, okay, the easement was granted to the individual using it, and presumably, I think we can all presume that the owner of the land maintained the right to control even that area. They could place what they wanted to on there. They maintained it. They mowed it. That didn't occur in this case. Well, it was transferred. I'm sorry.
What difference does that make? If the purpose behind the recreational use statute is to encourage owners to dedicate land to public use for recreational purposes, why would control make any difference in the analysis?
Because that is, by definition, what defines a premises liability case. It is the right of control over the premises upon which the individual is located. There is no other test. Owner, occupier, lessee, all those things are different terminologies in the courts.
The owner remains liable for some things.
The owner would only, I believe, remain liable for latent defects on that trail. Okay? And the distinction is the condition.
So if they're still liable for something, then the recreational use statute would still apply, wouldn't it?
It would if the defect was a latent defect on the trail itself, over a portion which they did retain control. Okay? And I think the court interprets that as these latent defects that an owner may have or may have knowledge of when they transfer the property to someone else, for instance, leasing a house to someone, and they know that the floor is rotten, but the person they lease it to doesn't know. Well, they retain, the law still leaves that duty on them to do something about it. But this is not a situation, this is not the situation here. We're talking about a condition that existed on a premises adjacent to an area over which they had no control. Now, the city could certainly enjoy a right, or would certainly be covered by the recreational use statute with respect to other conditions that might be on this trail. We can talk about roots that may be growing across it, limbs, things such as that. But the university has given up all control over this, and therefore they shouldn't enjoy, since it's not a premises liability case, the recreational use statute doesn't apply.
So you don't have a premises liability claim?
I don't believe it is a Keech premises liability case in that terminology. I don't think it is one where, for instance, it doesn't matter what the status of the individual on the property is.
I'm just wondering if you have a premises liability claim or not. I thought you told the trial judge that this was a premises liability case.
It's a premises liability case in that it deals with a defect on a premises. It is a condition of real property. Okay?
This is not the time to parse the language too finely. We just need to know, do you have a premises claim or not?
I think it may also be a negligent activity case,
Sean. Also or not, do you have a premises claim or not? That's just an easy question.
Your Honor, under Lee Lewis, I'm not sure. I'm actually not sure. When you look at Lee Lewis, the distinction between a negligent activity and the condition on a piece of property, and I think you pointed this out during arguments earlier, it gets very fine in the distinction of what that is. This is actually an oscillating sprinkler, so there is an activity going on. But someone put it there earlier. So is it a condition? Is it a negligent activity? Could it be both?
Well, would you answer the question? I know I'm switching course here, but the force of the water coming out of the sprinkler system being a design decision and not implementation.
I don't think we know the answer to that. I don't think the factual record.
Don't we just sort of intuitively know that whatever force comes out of a sprinkler is part of the design?
It was part of the design of the sprinkler, not necessarily the SFA didn't design the sprinkler. I'm sure they just chose a sprinkler head. We don't know that because it wasn't factually developed at the trial.
But even if they chose the system knowing what the pressure was, that would still be a policy decision.
If there was some policy decision made by SFA where the individuals formulating the policy got together and discussed how pressure the sprinkler should have,
well,
then I agree.
Even if they did.
Then no, I don't think it would be.
Well, let's say they've got a brochure that said this is the pound pressure in this particular sprinkler system, and they say, okay, we're going to buy it. That's a policy decision as well.
It possibly could be. I don't think we can tell that, though, from the factual record. We don't have any evidence of whether they even knew what the power of it was when they got it. I think all those things would have to be factually developed at the trial court level in order to attack jurisdiction for that reason, and that wasn't done. We don't know who decided to put the sprinkler there, other than it was an employee of SFA. We don't know whether some authority was delegated and some individual landscaper was told, here, go make sure that the it gets watered. Clearly, that wouldn't be the type of individual.
Do you have any beef with how Mr. Kraft characterized the deposition testimony?
Yes, I do. Especially the way he characterized the deposition testimony of Ms. Flynn with regards to whether or not she appreciated the oscillating sprinkler coming across the trail. The evidence was not such, was not that. The evidence was that she didn't appreciate that the sprinkler was oscillating across the path of it until she was about 4 feet from it. And in fact, that is the portion of her testimony that he quotes in his brief. It is that she recognized it was coming across when she was about 4 feet from it. At that point, there was nothing she could do.
Is there any evidence that anyone who set up the sprinkler knew that the force of that sprinkler would knock somebody off a bicycle and yet went ahead and set up the sprinkler across the path anyway?
Your Honor, to be honest with you, I don't recall that. And the reason they certainly knew how far it would project the water. And it was
aiming it across the path where people would go back and forth. Any evidence that they knew that it was going to do that?
Yes.
There is?
Yes. Now, that's not in the record, but yes.
We need to know what's in the record.
Well, Your Honor, that is part of the problem. I wanted to address this anyway. With respect to the issue of whether or not there's gross negligence in this case, which would exempt it even if the recreational use statute applied. Judge, the reason that wasn't briefed by me is because that is a factual dispute that should really be handled, in my opinion, more properly at the trial court level. What he has raised are issues that may preclude judgment or may be ripe for summary judgment with affidavits and the like, but not, in my opinion, Judge, under the existing case law, a factual dispute that ought to be developed from the standpoint of filing a motion or a plea to the jurisdiction.
Okay, well, but if it is a premises case, and if the recreational use statute does apply, do have to allege gross negligence and sufficient facts to raise that issue in order to win, don't you?
Yes, Your Honor. And we pled it. The question is whether we have to raise sufficient facts in a plea to the jurisdiction. And Your Honor, I don't think that's the law. If they filed a motion for summary judgment on the basis of not having evidence of gross negligence, that would be different.
Well, but if you say that there's gross negligence, but the only facts that you allege are ordinary negligence, do you think that's enough?
No, Your Honor. If we allege in our pleadings facts that were only sufficient, if proven, to show simple negligence and the recreational use statute applies, no, Your Honor. We should lose. I don't think that's the case. I think the pleadings clearly set forth that they knew it. The pleadings state they knew it was a dangerous condition. They knew it was going to go across the trail. My client didn't know it was going to go across the trail. They knew it was going to be dangerous, and they willfully and wantonly disregarded that risk. That's what the pleadings are in this case.
If you plead gross negligence and sufficient facts for that pleading and the recreational use statute applies, then the state comes in, Stephen F. Austin, with facts that it says negates gross negligence, even at a plea to the jurisdiction stage. Don't you have to raise facts at least sufficient to raise a fact question?
Your Honor, that is not how I interpret the status of the law. When it talks about generally, you look no further than the pleadings in determining a plea to the jurisdiction. Do the pleadings, as the plaintiff has set forth, plead sufficient facts to overcome sovereign immunity? Now, there are cases in which the court may hear evidence as to a jurisdictional fact, but, Your Honor, I don't think jurisdictional facts go to the heart of the case of whether or not there's gross negligence or not. It may go to whether or not they had control over it. It may go to whether or not it was a special defect versus a regular defect.
Well, did you plead facts, or did you just plead it's a danger? Did you just conclude it's a danger, or did you actually plead facts?
I pled facts, Your Honor.
And what facts did you plead? How much force there is, or what facts did you plead as opposed to merely saying this is a danger and they knew about it and they were grossly negligent? What facts did you plead that would make us go on the pleadings instead of the pleadings and the evidence?
What was pled, Your Honor, was that the university placed this oscillating sprinkler that posed a danger to those traveling up and down the trail.
Why was it a danger? I mean, they placed it there as a fact. It's a danger is a conclusion, isn't it?
Because it could knock individuals off their bikes who were traveling up and down the trail.
Okay.
And they knew that individuals were traveling up and down the trail by bicycle, and that if they were knocked off their bike, that they could become seriously injured. And that they disregarded that risk, even knowing it, and that that constitutes gross
negligence. Well, if that pleading is enough to get you there, what if you pled that we were riding down a sidewalk and this oscillating sprinkler in a neighbor's house of ours got me in the eyes and blinded me and I fell off, and that's a danger, and if we just plead that and don't have to look behind it, then every pleading is going to plead gross negligence, is it not? Unless we know something more other than that they knew it would knock somebody off. You can always say that.
Your Honor, I agree. I agree you certainly can, but that is the reason we have summary judgment. That is the vehicle by which to resolve those types of issues, not in a plea to the jurisdiction. If there aren't sufficient facts, then file a motion for summary judgment, file controverting affidavits, and let the trial judge decide whether there are. I think that's where that issue is better left.
It's just hard to imagine circumstances in which setting up an ordinary sprinkler would be gross negligence.
I agree, setting up an ordinary sprinkler.
Was there anything extraordinary about this sprinkler?
It shot over 100 feet. It was a powerful sprinkler. Plus, Your Honor, getting into the facts again, which I really have tried to avoid, simply because I don't think they're relevant to this inquiry about how it traverses the property, but there was nothing to water on the other side of this trail.
What difference does that make?
Because no one would expect a sprinkler to come across this trail and fly off into the woods. That's my point. As you're traveling down this trail, they're watering nothing. They're watering the woods and the trail. If it had oscillated correctly, or what I think would have been correctly, it never would have touched Miss Flynn.
It's still hard for me to imagine circumstances where watering nothing is grossly negligent.
Well, Your Honor, I think...
Maybe it's a waste of water, but... it's just kind of hard to see how that's grossly negligent.
It's a stream that was powerful enough to knock her off her bike. I mean, that's the allegation. Those are the facts. And like I said, if this were, the facts might be different. But once again, we're getting into what exactly the facts are with respect to gross negligence. And I keep asking the court, let the trial court do that. Let us present evidence of what that is. And a plea to the jurisdiction is not the appropriate vehicle.
Counsel,
to do
doesn't
that.
Miranda and Bland, don't they both say that under appropriate circumstances, facts may have to be considered at the jurisdictional stage?
Yes, Your Honor. And I addressed that earlier, what I think those types of facts are. I don't think they go to the issue of whether the defendant was negligent or not, or whether the defendant was grossly negligent or not.
You sounded like you were saying earlier that control is an issue under the recreational use statute.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe
why?
That. And I believe the reason that is because, once again, I think as it uses the term trespasser, I think it is contemplating clearly traditional premises liability law. And the case that I was going to point out, this is most closely like a case where an individual is walking down a sidewalk, a public sidewalk, and something from a building next to it falls off.
What if this university, instead of having a sprinkler system, planted some trees? And a beautification project, and somebody's jogging along, the tree falls on that person and injures them. Facts are important.
Those facts are. I agree, Your Honor. And that may be as a matter of law. If that was what was pled and there wasn't anything else pled, such as knowledge that the tree was going to fall and disregarding of that knowledge, certainly just because a tree falls, it's not their fault. It's no one's fault.
Well,
that happens.
As Justice Sixth said, maybe in that situation, you can envision where an entity may be grossly negligent, but grossly negligent for even the wrongful implementation of a sprinkler system seems to me to be a significant reach.
Your Honor, and I can understand that without having the facts developed in the trial court level, but I keep going back to that is a factual determination that would ultimately be made by a jury or through summary judgment would be made by a judge, by the trial court, who had knowledge of all the facts as they came in by affidavit. I just don't believe it's a vehicle that ought to be handled in a plea to the jurisdiction.
And so the case should be sent down for those facts to be developed?
Sure. Yes, Your Honor.
What facts would need to be developed in order to make the discretionary decision determination?
As to whether or not there was sufficient evidence of gross negligence?
No, whether the operation of the sprinkler was a discretionary function. I mean, it seems to me that the policy making and the implementation distinction is we want to protect government employees for discretionary decisions at whatever level they make them. And if, for example, this sprinkler system was bought with no directive, you know, do it this way on this day at this time at this pressure, whoever's making it day to day, that decision, is going to be entitled to the protection of making that discretionary decision. So either way, it seems like the discretionary piece doesn't work here.
I'm not sure I follow you. Are you saying that if the individual was told to do it this way, water on these days, water at this time, water this location?
Then it seems to me that would be the implementation part, that it's no longer discretionary. You've been told how to do it. But I think in response to my last question to you was, if the pressure is determined by the people who bought the sprinkler system, if that's just built into the system, then clearly that's a policy decision for which the government's entitled to immunity.
I'm not sure I would agree. I'm not sure that watering the shot put field is the type of governmental discretionary action that was anticipated to be covered by. And I go back to the language of State v. Terrell that this court rendered back in 1979 and states only those acts or omissions which constitute the execution of or the actual making of those policy decisions were intended to be excluded. And it seems to me that it's these types of policy decisions that a police force does, whether to send three officers out versus five, whether to put a stop sign up versus not put a stop sign up, not the type of decision of whether or not you should water at 5 o'clock or 10 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning.
Well, why not? I mean, it seems to me like that's as discretionary as you can get, when something needs watering and how you're going to go about watering it. I mean, isn't that core discretionary activity?
I can envision a circumstance where it may be, but I think it would depend on who made those decisions and under the circumstances in which they were made. I don't think if an individual, a landscaper, is given the obligation of just watering the yard, water the shot put field, an hourly employee, and he goes out and he decides that he's going to water at 5 o'clock in the afternoon when everyone's running, I'm not sure that is a policy decision that's anticipated or that's subject to the discretionary act exception to sovereign immunity. But I think those facts would have to be developed.
Any further questions? Thank you,
counsel. Thank you.
What about the idea that here the condition existed not on the bike path but on property adjacent to the bike path? Does that make a difference in your mind?
It doesn't make a difference because the area of the easement is still university property, so it doesn't matter. It's still university property. And I want to address a couple of record issues first. Mr. Allen said in his argument that the easement was transferred to the city and the city dedicated this to public use. That's not what he pled. Page 85 of the record, paragraph 12, on information and belief, that portion of the trail running through Stephen F. Austin State University property was an easement owned by the city of Nacogdoches and dedicated to public use by Stephen F. Austin State University. So it's that dedication that directs the use of this easement for a walking, jogging, cycling trail.
Counsel, is there any evidence in the record about what type of transfer happened between the state, between the college and the city? We've heard the term transfer several times.
There's not any record evidence of that. We're
so
going solely on his
pleadings. The only thing we have to go on is his pleadings there?
All we have to go on is his pleadings. And his pleading is that it was a dedication to public use by the university. And as a matter of law, you have to have some public entity owning that dedicated public easement to accept it for the public and complete the dedication. But it's the dedication by the university that dictates what this is going to be for. The city doesn't have the control that Mr. Allen says it does. They could not set up a barricade right where the trail starts on Stephen F. Austin State
University. Is that in the record? Is that in the record?
That's a matter of law.
Well, but what's in the record about what the city could or could not do? That's what I'm asking. What kind of transfer do we have? Or do we know anything other than his pleadings?
We only know what he said, which is dedicated to public use by Stephen F. Austin State University.
So I guess the university could actually have deeded that to the city, for all we know.
But the allegation is that it was dedicated to public use.
Yeah,
so that's all we have to
go. The allegation is he transferred it to the city.
But
so if it transferred it to the city by deed, we have a conflict somewhere in there. I'm trying to figure out what we do know, and all we know is what's in his pleadings, and those seem to be somewhat conflicting.
I don't think there's a conflict because his pleadings do not say there was a transfer. It says the city owned it. It was dedicated to public use by the university. There's nothing conflicting about that. You can dedicate an easement for public use that will be owned by the public entity, but that dedication directs what it's for. The university could not set up the city could not set up a barricade where the trail starts on the university's campus and say, nobody can jog here anymore, because that's inconsistent with the dedication, and that's just a matter of law. The other record issue I wanted to address is what Mrs. Flynn testified to when she entered the shot put field. She said when she entered the shot put field, as soon as she was at the southern boundary, she sees the sprinkler spraying a big stream of water in the northeastern corner of the field. She puts her head down, continues riding. The first time she becomes aware it is oscillating is when she's 4 to 6 feet away from it. But just because she put her head down doesn't mean this isn't open and obvious. And we know that from her husband's testimony, because her husband said, I rode toward the sprinkler and I was watching it, and while I was watching it, it was oscillating. So that establishes that this is an open and obvious condition. As to the issue of, because it's oscillating, is this an activity? Just because it's moving doesn't mean it can't be a condition of the premises. There's no requirement that a premises condition be static. Running water can be a condition. Smoke can be a condition. So just because this is moving doesn't mean it's an activity. Mr. Allen questioned whether gross negligence is a jurisdictional fact. It is a jurisdictional fact. Otherwise, this court would not have gone to the trouble in Miranda and in Shoemake of going through the evidence to see whether gross negligence could be established by that evidence. It is a jurisdictional fact by virtue of the recreational use statute, because it limits the waiver of immunity that Mrs. Flynn has invoked in the Tort Claims Act.
Let's step back a few steps. When you're talking about the pleadings as to who dedicated the easement for public use, under the recreational use statute, that's relevant to giving permission and the recreational purpose for the property?
Yes.
Okay. What, if any, role does control have under the recreational use statute?
It doesn't have any role, because there's nothing in the statute that says you have to maintain control. And if the court were to read that into the statute, it would be contrary to the statute's purpose.
The Court of Appeals talked about control in the context of the recreational use statute.
Yes,
just a misread of the statute, do you think?
That is incorrect. I think that has no basis in the law. Otherwise, landowners would say, I need to restrict access to my property because I have to maintain the requisite level of control in order to have the protection of the recreational use statute. And that's inconsistent with the statute's purpose.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Kraft. The call is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.